A mad rush at one local site to get the COVID vaccine. Diversity meetings at Douglas Anderson go awry. And a downtown homeless camp is going to be dispersed. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5 on this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Join us. Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, celebrating 10 years of Mocha Jacksonville's acclaimed Project Atrium series. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a busy week in the news, we welcome Ann Schindler of First Coast News. Hi, Ann.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
Great to have you. John Burr of Resilient Jacks on the line. John, good morning. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, great to be here. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday. And A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics. Hi, A.G.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning, everyone, and so excited to have you on this Friday, the first Friday in March. As we discuss the top stories of the week, we want to hear from you, too, everyone out there. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax, and our Facebook page is open. Lots to talk about this week. We'll go to all of your calls in a moment, but let's begin with some confusion, I guess it's fair to say, that we saw around town over just who is eligible to get a COVID vaccine. Now, of course, earlier this week, the governor said only teachers over 50 could get the shot, but then some places like CVS pharmacies overrode the governor and started offering the vaccine to all teachers. The governor now says teachers of any age can be vaccinated at all of the federally supported vaccination sites in Florida. People are wondering what age bracket might be next. The governor predicted younger people might never even crack 50% vaccination rates. And at the same time, we saw a rush of hundreds of standbys, I guess you could call them, at the new federal gateway site on the north side when they opened up Wednesday. People showed up between 5 and 6 hoping to get a leftover shot, since we had been told that the gateway site could vaccinate at least 2,000 people a day. Most of those people did get turned away. They are not in the eligible list just yet. Now, amidst all of this, 3.2 Florida residents have received at least one dose of vaccine. Even though deaths keep ticking up every day, we do have that positive news to report. So we're going to begin the hour with a closer look at the vaccination rollout around the region. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And once again, as I said, our Facebook page is open. Ann Schindler, let's begin with you. Federal authorities seem to be moving ahead of the governor somewhat, along with private corporations like CVS, in working to get shots in arms. And we saw a bit of that at the Gateway site Wednesday. There were anecdotal reports of people being vaccinated there, even though they didn't officially qualify. But then between 5 and 6 o'clock at night, the protocol there seemed to change, and hundreds of people did get turned away. So, you know, we're seeing more eagerness for people to, they want shots in arms, particularly now that there's more vaccine supply out there. You've been following this as well. What have you been observing?
Well, tremendous chaos, really, Melissa. I mean, there has been such a lack of communication, it seems, between the state and federal providers about who qualifies, what is going to be done with doses that are available but not administered. And it's been very frustrating. I mean, we saw people this week who are medically needy, who left their house on a rare occasion to try to get this shot and were actually turned away because they were told there weren't medical providers available to assess them as medically needy, even though they had a note from their doctor. And then, you know, a lot of questions. I mean, I personally know of people who have gotten the shot that don't qualify, who've gone for these sort of end-of-day scraps.
Sure.
And we've gotten, you know, mixed messages about whether that is or is not available. So, you know, there has been a lack of coordination, and certainly it's been difficult to get answers from the agencies. There was some information one of the press people put out this week, one of the spokespeople for the state. She even ended up having to delete her tweet because it was contrary to what the information was that was coming out from FEMA. So it's been it's been a challenge. I mean, obviously there's going to be hiccups. I think everybody understands it. But it is, I think, a little frustrating for the people who are, you know, caught in the middle.
Of course. A.G. Gankarski, how do you rate the Governor DeSantis's response to this mixed messaging, confusion at some sites? And in particular, he's been criticized for not providing a timeline for when the next categories of people are eligible to receive the vaccine. That has been done in other states. That might go a long way toward, I don't know, calming people down as they know when they will be next eligible. The governor has said he doesn't want to do that, though, because he might have to change the plans depending on vaccine supply. What are you hearing from Tallahassee about this?
Well, this particular governor is basically dealing with a couple of different messaging tracks, and the one that I watch most closely is national politics. I mean, he's obviously being talked up as a major contender for 2024 and so on. So, you know, the governor's messaging to a national audience while at the same time, you know, running the state's vaccine program. You're seeing more of the federal buy-in with the FEMA sites and all of that and teacher expansion.
Yep, we lost AG there. We'll try to get you back. We've got everybody linked up virtually, so we asked the audience to roll with us and support our socially distanced program. John Burr of Resilient Jacks, you know, as AG said, Governor DeSantis is a favorite among the conservative base to run for president in 2024. He's also faced criticism not only for these issues with the communication flow around the vaccination rollout, but also he's faced criticism, according to some, for making wealthy enclaves more easily able to get the vaccine, particularly those that have donated to him. The governor denies that there's any kind of pay-to-play process for vaccines in Florida, although top Democrats like Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried are calling for an FBI investigation into all of this. So what about that?
Yeah, the politics is very heavy over this issue, and you know, it's really a shame because this has been true for the last year. Really, as everything related to the pandemic has become very political, and as has been said a million times, the virus doesn't care about politics. The virus strikes whoever can strike. You know, so. This is, you know, I think kind of we're on the verge of a wave of vaccine availability here in the next couple of weeks. I think a lot of these restrictions will just kind of melt away, and hopefully we'll be on a better path for getting people inoculated. Everybody inoculated.
I hope so. I hope so so much. Ann Schindler, let's hope that all of this is moot in a few more weeks, and certainly by the end of next month, as the majority of Americans by that point should be eligible to be vaccinated.
Yeah, the optimists among us will say there is a light at the end of the tunnel, and you are starting to see signs of it. Certainly there's more discussion now about returning to the workplace. I know that's something that we've been discussing internally. You know, we've still been very remote in terms of how we put our shows together. And I've been talking to other people in media about how that is maybe starting to coalesce again. But I do think it's going to be interesting to see, I mean, sort of unrelated to the vaccine issue, but just how we're going to move on from this largely work from home era and how offices are going to change and adapt and maybe in some cases never be the same, you know, what they were previously in terms of how people reported to work. But yeah, I think that the vaccine thing will start to get easier, just as we saw with the testing. You know, initially it was a lot of confusion, a lot of, you know, wait time. And I think, again, as the vaccines become more available, we're going to see, you know, just less confusion around who and when and what the rules are.
Let's hope so. By the way, A.G. Gankarski, what about this? The Diocese of St. Augustine this week posted guidance on their website from leaders of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. They are suggesting that Catholics steer clear of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine if other options are available. It was produced in part through the use of cell lines from fetal tissue. Now, that said, of course, health officials are telling people, take whatever vaccine you can. Take the first one that's available.
Yeah, the Catholic Church needs to clean up its own yard rather than getting into vaccine politics. I understand the concern that fetal tissue was used in the developmental phase of this, but it seems like a curious thing for the diocese to wade into, given its issues with civil litigation and attrition of, you know, people actually going to the churches and so on. But, you know, that's Catholicism in the 21st century. It's, you know, this culture war prestige stuff. But, you know, for people trying to get the vaccine, they're by and large going to get whatever they can get.
Here's an email from Mary in Ortigas. She writes, my husband was turned away from the FEMA site Wednesday night. We have a high-risk child and want to protect him. Hundreds of people were lined up and wanted vaccines in their arms. We need shots in arms to get closer to herd immunity. If someone is willing to get a shot and there are shots available and staff to administer those shots, let's get them in arms, especially when so many people in Jacksonville have stopped wearing masks. I was at that site, too, John Burr, Wednesday night, and it was remarkable to see people turned away like that when there was supply available. But we were told that they were simply following the regulations as to who's eligible to be vaccinated right now.
There last night, Melissa, and the same thing played out. There were probably 150 people that were around 6:15 or so were told, hey, it ain't happening for you guys today. Unless you meet the criteria, go home. You know, it is very frustrating for people who really want and need these shots. However, if you don't follow the criteria, you really are going to have chaos, not just frustration, but real chaos, because, you know, people will show up by the thousands.
Yeah, I mean, Ann Schindler, why not have two tracks now that the supply is opening up so much? Vaccinate the vulnerable, give them first priority, but allow the general population to come in and be sanctioned to be vaccinated if there is supply. Because as you said, we've been hearing anecdotally for weeks now that they're sort of doing that under the table when they can. They're giving out leftover shots to anyone who asks unofficially.
So I think partly because the people giving the shots are reasonable people and they know that people need to get vaccinated. And if they have leftover shots, they need to be administered. I mean, we all heard stories about the snowstorm when, you know, cars were being stuck and there was vaccine in transit and people were just walking up and down and trying to use the shots before they expired. There is a, you know, a shelf life for these. And obviously, if people are coming and they're medically needy or they're living with someone who's medically needy and a caregiver, people who are in the healthcare field are inclined to help them. And it's really the directives that they've been getting, and sometimes very conflicting directives that they've been getting from different agencies that has created the confusion. I think that the people who are on site giving the doses are willing to make those available. And I think that that's why there has been some availability. Because, frankly, when you're on those sites and giving those shots and you know that there's a shelf life, it makes sense.
Sure.
And unfortunately, it doesn't always accord with policy. So
it's our Friday roundtable. What are your thoughts about vaccination rollout in our area? 549-2937. Let's go to your calls. Linda in Mandarin, you're on the air. Linda, happy Friday.
Happy Friday. I told the young lady, I think the biggest thing is that I don't have $250,000 to give the governor for me and my friends to get vaccinated. I've been in my house since last March, and I've only gone to one outdoor function at Comer. I want the shot, but I'm not quote-unquote available. But let's be real. The states have the ability to fill out the guidelines, which Governor DeSantis has done. He's not going by the CDC guidelines. So the fact that that was shut down on Wednesday, I think had to do with them getting wind that people who weren't in that group were getting shot. To me, the federal site should be allowed to expand because, you know, Joe Biden helped bring that to underserved communities. And if any person in an unserved community wants to get a shot, those people who were there at 5 o'clock had just gotten off work. But because Governor DeSantis didn't prioritize, you know, essential workers, they haven't gotten their shot. So I'm just, my goal in March is to get a shot somewhere, somehow, I have to go to get a note from my doctor's office to then take it to a site. That's another barrier for people who have health issues, but you need to get a form signed by your doctor and pick it up and print it out and take it to, it's just too much. It's too much.
Yeah.
And Governor DeSantis, he's giving the vaccine, 3,000 to a community in South Florida, to people who are over 65, who are probably not in the workforce and probably could shelter in place a little longer. But no, let's not do right. Let's just do what is good for his campaign in 2022. Thanks, guys.
All right, Linda. AG Gankarski, you know, of course, the governor has denied any sort of pay-to-play situation in terms of the vaccination rollout around the state. Our Florida Public Radio has spoken with FEMA about the FEMA sites around the state. And what we're told is that the state selected these sites. FEMA is partnering with the Florida Division of Emergency Management, and the state is actually operating the FEMA sites for all intents and purposes. FEMA providing logistical support and administering the vaccine. So with regard to what happened at the Gateway site Wednesday evening, it did appear as though there was a change in protocol around 6 o'clock. I was there too. And people did get turned away, whereas previously, at least some people who just walked up were being vaccinated. And so not only, to Linda's point, are some essential workers still having to wait their turn. The other interesting thing that happened with the Gateway site, AG, was that people that saw the social media discussion about it couldn't help but point out that it was probably the most white people that had been at the Gateway site in many, many years. And it was an opportunity for African Americans to note that this is a part of town that many white people never visit. And it might have been the first time for them to notice that it's run down and needs a lot in the way of infrastructure improvements. So that was interesting to note, too.
Yeah, we'll see what that catalyzes in terms of an infrastructure debate. But, yeah, I mean, with DeSantis and the Biden administration, there are going to be hiccups. There's going to be posturing. There's going to be changes wherever. I mean, the governor started off talking about FEMA camps a few weeks back, and he's gradually softened his position of saying that he'll accept help from FEMA. He just doesn't want it to cut into the state's efforts and so on. And, you know, he gives two different types of messages, of course, at a press conference versus a Fox News hit. So you've got that happening at the same time. But, you know, ultimately, it's going to be an easier path because demand is going to slacken. The eligibility is going to be expanded and so on. The governor's really bet heavily in the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, the Catholic concerns notwithstanding. You know, he says it's a one shot. He says it's easier for workforce situations. And Johnson & Johnson may be the path that essential workers under the age of 65 without pre-existing conditions, that may be how they get their vaccines in the end.
Mm. Let's go to Lucy. Lucy is on the line. Hi, Lucy. Good morning.
Hi. I just wanted to make a quick comment that I am a senior. I am not rich. But I got mine through, it just was a text message from my hospital. So even though I'm a Democrat, I don't know if you can condemn DeSantis if your hospital sends you a text saying, come on in, because I'm not wealthy. I am not. And I am a senior, but I got a text from my hospital to come on in. I do have a patient portal, and I do have primary care. That's all I have. sick.
I'm glad to hear you got the shot, Lucy. Anyone of any background, income level, political persuasion, the goal is let's just get everyone vaccinated when we can. It's 549-2937. It's our Friday roundtable as we talk about the top stories of the week. Here's an email from a listener. I feel that the governor is a bit clueless about this. He's whining a lot and being petty. It would be foolish to expect he would ever be a strong leader, especially when we need leadership right now. Now, John Burr, that said, although the governor is divisive and certainly has his critics, he is above 50% approval in the state. The majority of Floridians, a slim majority, but a majority, approve of the job he's doing as he heads into a reelection campaign in 2022.
Yeah, he's about over 50%, and he's growing. So a lot of people think he's actually doing things correctly. It just strikes me that I just feel in my gut that in 2 weeks to a month at the latest, these vaccines will be available, as Ann noted, in the same pattern as the test work became suddenly available. And, hopefully people will take advantage of that and get their shots, and it's going to be a much easier and much smoother process than we're seeing today.
Let's hope so. And it's our Friday Media Roundtable as we talk about the top stories of the week. We've been talking about the ongoing hiccups with the vaccine rollout around the state. It's 549-2937 to join the show. We're going to shift topics now. Speaking of politics, the local Duval Democratic Party is consumed with infighting, as has been reported, and they have yet to field a candidate for Jacksonville mayor. Meantime, the two top Republican candidates in the race so far, Daniel Davis and Matt Carlucci, are posting impressive fundraising numbers. The mayor's race for Jacksonville isn't until 2023, Ann Schindler. We got some ways to go here. But it's been remarkable to watch the local Democratic Party implode after Joe Biden won this county in 2020. They can't get their act together, and the Republicans are off and running.
Yeah, it is a early start to this race. And, you know, money is making itself known already in terms of, you know, who the favored candidates are. And of course, you know, the list of donors is all of the usual people that we know typically make candidates succeed. So those people have already committed a big amount of money. I mean, it's astonishing how much cash is already kind of in the game. And, you know, I don't know what it is with the Democrats. It does seem that they're a little flat-footed on this jump. I don't know if it's that they didn't have, you know, enough decision-making about who is going to run. But I am frankly surprised that we haven't seen a couple of the people that were rumored to be potential candidates try to, you know, at least insert themselves into the discussion at this stage so that they're not written off entirely.
A.G. Gankarski.
Yeah. Boy, I'll tell you. Duval Democrats, they've got a registration advantage. They would seem to have all the momentum in the world, and it's a circular firing squad over there. This whole issue with Daniel Henry, the chair, various local leaders, it makes them all look bad. Nobody comes out of this looking good. The people calling for the chair's resignation don't look good. The chair certainly doesn't look good. You know, it's an abomination, and you have to wonder why the Florida Democratic Party hasn't stepped in and refereed a little bit. I mean, cycle after cycle, we see this rudderless state party basically sleepwalking, doing the Ric Flair flop, as they lose election after election in the state. And yet again, you've got a major party in Northeast Florida and they're not doing anything about it. And Daniel Davis is going to bring home all the Tallahassee money. Matt Carlucci is basically like cleaning up on the white Democrats, and there's not really going to be a lane for a Democrat which a few weeks ago, if you told me that, I would have thought it was incredible.
Yeah. John Burr, let me correct myself. Daniel Davis has not officially declared yet, although he is widely expected to run. He's already raised millions. He's currently the CEO of the Jacksonville Chamber. Jacksonville City Councilman Matt Carlucci has declared. He's raised over $500,000. So, you know, I think AG's right in the sense that Carlucci will draw, if no Democrat runs, Carlucci will draw a lot of Democratic votes in this mayor's race. The question is, you know, will the Democrats be able to field a candidate at this? We'll have to see.
Yeah, it's a tough ask for any Democrat in Duval County to run for mayor's office. But, you know, the Democratic Party has to run someone. It was a terrible look in the last election when they failed to even field a candidate for mayor. If they did that twice in a row, it would be, it would just really just highlight how irrelevant they are in Duval County. They have to field someone, but on the same time, who's going to step into the breach against Carlucci and Davis? That's a tough ask.
It's 549-2937. We're talking vaccinations, politics, and more on the show. Let's go to Wayne in Jacksonville. Hi, Wayne. Good morning.
Hello.
Hi, Wayne.
Yes. Hi. The state is not allowing the county to make appointments, and the state has a gateway on their portal system for making appointments. That is part of the problem with respect to the logistics and with respect to the federal site. So I think that it is important for individuals that are with health conditions or pre-existing conditions or other issues to work through some medical provider in order to obtain an appointment. Until the state actually will answer their call center phone line, you're going to have a challenge in obtaining an appointment with the state system.
How about you, Wayne? Have you struggled? Have you been vaccinated?
I work on secure facilities and have independently been able to forward my vaccination. So my situation is a little bit different.
I see. All right. Well, thank you for that, Wayne. Thanks for that feedback. It's 549-2937. Constance has a vaccination question. Hi, Constance. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Melissa. My question is, upon listening to the governor's talk a day or so ago, he said that people could be inoculated in their home. My sister is unable to walk. She's unable to roll over, wheelchair bound. She lives in Palm Beach County. And I needed a phone number so that I could call and find out if she is able to get an in-home vaccination.
Right. And Constance, thank you for that. Ann Schindler, there is a path for that to happen, but I would have to Google to get the phone number and try to get that information to Constance. But that is happening, is my understanding.
I am sorry. For some reason, my sound dropped out on her, and I didn't actually hear her question.
Yeah,
she had a wheelbarrow.
Yeah, she's got a homebound relative that wants to be vaccinated at home.
Okay, that I have not. I'm not familiar with that. I do believe that there is an option on that. I've heard about it, but I don't have any direct information. But I also will Google around on it and see.
Constance, if you're still listening, what I would suggest that you do is call your county health department and start from there and keep calling if you have trouble getting through. I know that there are so many questions about this, and we're going to keep talking about other news of the week, but we continue to get a lot of calls about vaccinations for no surprise at all. Let's go to Mark in Mandarin. He's got a comment about this. Hi, Mark. Mark, you're on the air. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm over 65. And Jacksonville was giving out shots at two senior centers to anyone over 65. I went on the second week that I could have gone, and when I left early afternoon, they said if you know anyone who wants to assist over 65 or who's born in January and February, because it was by date of birth, then call them, because we still have shots to give out. So it doesn't surprise me that there's a community, whether it's wealthy or not, that had a lot of people over 65 that where everyone went to one got a shot, because Jacksonville was doing it too.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks for that, Mark. That is certainly a valid point to make. Elizabeth is on the line. Elizabeth, good morning. Go ahead, Elizabeth. Okay, we'll try to connect Elizabeth again. John Burr, you know, senior communities have been incredibly proactive, as the caller said, in getting shots into arms all over Florida.
Well, and rightly so. Obviously, people 65 and up are more vulnerable to the to COVID. You know, again, if we stick with you know, the medical reasons for giving people vaccinations instead of trying to look for the political machinations of it, I think people will calm down and have a little more patience with the process.
It's 549-2937. As we talk about the biggest stories of the week, we'll continue to take your calls if you have vaccine questions, but we're going to move on now and get into a few other news and notes from the week. This one was nuts. A school meeting at Douglas Anderson that was supposed to focus on diversity and inclusion blew up into a huge controversy. It drew so much criticism that administrators were forced to cancel it. Ann Schindler, the principal at the school, Melanie Hammer, said that the school would be hosting two meetings to discuss cultural issues that have arisen on campus for high school juniors and seniors. The first time slot was reserved for students of color, the second for white students, and the point of the separate meetings, the principal said, was to give students of color a safe space to air their grievances and not feel like they needed to educate their white peers about their struggles. The diversity consultants say they've used that tactic before in educational settings. However, it backfired. Students loudly protested the perception of segregated meetings, and so the whole thing got canceled.
Yeah, the optics were terrible. And, you know, it's one of the reasons that when we talk about discussions around race, everybody always says these are difficult conversations. And one of the reasons they're difficult conversations is because it can be a little bit of a minefield. And in this case, the organizers of this, the consultants who planned this meeting, did this deliberately. They did it so that, I mean, I think anybody who's been to quote unquote like a diversity seminar knows that white people are sometimes, it takes them a little longer to get it, right? And their goal was to like kind of save that painful process so that, you know, that students of color could talk about their grievances and their issues and not necessarily have to kind of, you know, sit through that learning curve and also be able to express their feelings freely. And so that was the goal. It's an admirable goal. It's an approach that has worked in other educational settings. But you know, it's the kind of thing that is needs to be handled carefully, and perhaps in this case just wasn't as smooth as it should have been. I think that if they had approached it somewhat differently or had involved some student leaders in the plan instead of just sort of announcing it and pushing it out over an email, they probably would have had more buy-in. I don't think that the goal is objectionable, but I do think that the optics were really bad.
Yeah. A.G. Gankarski, as Ann said, this gives you an idea of the difficulty administrators have in schools and other settings in trying to make a good faith effort to create a better climate for everyone in the institution to have open discussions about race and inequality and privilege and all of those concepts. It can be a very difficult job.
You know, I've said this periodically, and eventually people are going to hear me. This post 9/11 generation of kids is different.
Yeah.
They expect more honesty. They expect more candor. They don't have any illusions that the world's going to keep getting better for them. They're aware that they have inherited a country in decline, and they want answers. And this whole discussion about race at Douglas Anderson is just one plank in a larger structure, you know, of questions they have about a prevailing social order, you know, these intersectional questions, as we like to call them, regarding race, class, ethnicity, gender, what it means to be any of these things, all of these things are going to come up. And the 20th century structures have no answers for them, just as they really had no answers for the kids of the 20th century. So what we are seeing is a perestroika of the mind.
John Burr, I love that. John Burr, you know, we have two students at Douglas Anderson in our household, and AAG is right. The student body at DA is not shy at all. And this whole generation is not shy at all about telling adults exactly what they think of the older generation's managing of not only this issue, but any issue. They are, the 9/11 generation is different. That is absolutely true. And it will be fascinating to see how things go once they are adults.
Well, yeah, I'm God bless them. I would much rather have a generation of young people who are questioning and speaking out rather than docile and acceptant. You know, I came of age in the 70s, and believe me, there was plenty of speaking out and talking back to parents then, too, and questioning the foundations of our culture and our country. I get what people are saying about the current generation, but, you know, a lot of this has to do with just being a teenager and a young adult and coming into the world and questioning, you know, the basis of the culture and the laws that that you're have to live under. I mean, this is a natural thing to a large extent, I think.
549-2937 as we talk news of the week. By the way, the lady that asked about homebound vaccination, there is a special program for Florida seniors, or excuse me, Florida veterans who need vaccinations at home. And a listener tweets the show that the Florida Department of Health in Palm Beach County is developing plans to address homebound seniors. So if you're still listening out there, call the County Health Department. That goes for everybody to get a question answered. And as we continue the discussion, it's our Friday Media Roundtable with Ann Schindler, John Burr, A.G. Gankarski, and myself, and your calls at 549-2937. Now, another big story from the week, citing health and safety violations, the city of Jacksonville is fencing off a La Villa block near downtown where homeless people have been living, sometimes by the hundreds, in an informal tent city. Residents there have been told they have to leave by next Tuesday. Ann Schindler, the Downtown Homelessness Task Force has been trying to relocate these residents into hotels and getting them into temporary housing. And we will see how this goes on Tuesday so that the people that have been living in tents in that empty block can hopefully take advantage of existing services that are out there.
Yeah, I think that what is happening on that block is just, you know, an indication of how unwieldy this problem can be sometimes for officials. And it's, you know, it seems strange that it should be so difficult to solve the problem of homelessness since it's eminently solvable with housing. Yet, in this case, you have a city that is, you know, implementing a let's get this camp moved into a more permanent place, right? Let's help these people find housing. And so they did this initiative where they're going to, you know, give them hotel rooms and give them services. And after they did that, the camp actually swells in size. And so it is a little bit counterintuitive. And the complaint we were hearing from people yesterday, as they were given notice that they were going to be removed from the camp and the camp was going to be, you know, sealed off, is that the city is offering them, you know, 30 days, basically. And these are people who've been homeless for a long time. 30 days is really meaningless. I mean, they probably occasionally have 30 days at a friend's house and or, you know, a family member's house. But ultimately, long term, they don't have secure housing. And, you know, some of them use the shelter sometimes, and then they find themselves back on the street for one reason or another. But their skepticism is warranted because, you know, a little window of respite from the streets is not a solution.
Yeah. AG, the city is going to fence off the spot so that people can't camp out there anymore. And we have seen the city work with agencies like Changing Homelessness and the Sulzbacher Center and really try to partner with these nonprofits in a productive way to try to address this. But we've watched it play out in real time, how difficult this is.
Yeah. And you know, compounding that difficulty is, you know, just a larger long-term collapse in the economy for working-class people. You know, you have a generation of people who never really recovered from the 2008 crash. You know, never mind anything that's happened since, never mind the COVID pandemic. You know, that might have been the last nail in the coffin in terms of being able to keep housing. And, you know, when people hear that the city's providing services in exchange for moving from the camp, you know, it's going to draw people to the camp because, you know, it's a leg up from the uncertainty of a shelter and so on. This is a major structural problem that walks hand in hand with the murder rate in the city, you know, with these other issues. And, you know, it suggests that this generation of political leaders was presented a group of problems and didn't really solve them. The next generation is going to have to solve them. And, you know, they're really more entrenched than they were.
You know, John Byrd, too, when you talk to people that are in this camp and then you talk to people who have opinions about the homeless camp, it's really fascinating. A number of people have asked me to mention that they believe that people are coming to this camp from out of town. When you talk to advocates for the homeless, what they will tell you is that there isn't a big increase in the number of homeless people, that there's always been about the same number of homeless people. It's just that because this camp sprung up, it's more visible now. It's more obvious. It's in our faces. But that this is basically the problem the city has had for a long time.
Yeah, the city has had it, and all cities have had it for, you know, we've seen it really for 30 years in a lot of cities. But it's hard for me to believe that the homeless problem is no worse today than it was in January of 2020 before COVID. I think the homeless situation is much worse because the unemployment situation is much worse. What these folks really need is a chance for a job. And I don't think political leaders are the ones that are going to give them a chance for a job. It's, you know, the economy, except to the extent that the political leaders can get us a stimulus bill to try to get the economy back. That is one thing that politics can help with.
And it has passed the U.S. House, that massive COVID relief bill. It now goes to the Senate. As we talk about the homeless camp in Jacksonville, let's go to Linnell in Mandarin. She's calling in. Hi, Linnell. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. I really appreciate y'all addressing this this issue that our city continues to struggle with. Andre Bailey, who is a gentleman known for helping to prevent and end homelessness down in Orlando, actually came to Jacksonville University and did a great presentation. And our mayor only sent one representative to that. And then, unfortunately, they never actually picked up the mantle of any of the work that needs to be done. But it really talks about the CEOs of the hospitals, the leaders of the nonprofit industry, the faith leaders, the chamber, the Small Business Administration, the veterans organizations, just a multitude of community members who all need to be in one room with the goal of preventing and ending homelessness. And we never actually seem to get to that point. We just perpetuate homelessness.
Linnell, thanks for that. Thanks for that insight. Ann Schindler, we do have an ending homelessness task force, a downtown homelessness task force in the city. But as the caller pointed out, other cities have taken an even bigger picture focus when it comes to this, like Orlando to our south.
Yeah, I mean, it's a resource issue. And, you know, this is one of those things that when it becomes visible and kind of a blight that the city leaders don't like to see, and something like this camp definitely, you know, qualifies as that. There is some action, there's some movement, there's some suddenly discovered funding. But again, long-term solutions require long-term financial commitments. And as I said earlier, it's a question of, you know, affordable housing, building it and keeping it affordable and keeping it something that people actually have access to without, you know, long, long waits, which currently there's, you know, an enormous backlog for affordable housing. And, you know, help finding those resources, help getting people into homes when they're available and helping keep them there so that, you know, again, with this eviction tidal wave possibly coming, you know, our colleague Nate Monroe wrote a really good piece about funding for Jacksonville area legal aid.
Yeah.
Kind of like the stopgap against another massive wave of people being evicted out, you know, onto the streets. And if we think this is a problem now, if that happens, you know, it's just going to grow. And the agency that can help prevent that isn't properly funded. So it isn't rocket science to figure out why it happens and that it might be happening more to a greater degree soon.
Comments on Facebook, Marjorie writes, the homeless problem has always been there, but as Springfield gentrifies and the city tears down more downtown buildings, it has become more visible. Maria on our Facebook page says, affordable housing for homeless, seniors, and those with mental and physical disabilities is a crisis. Thanks for that feedback, everybody. And I want to thank Ann Schindler, A.G. Gankarski, and John Burr for appearing on this show. Guys, thank you so much, and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you so much. In a moment, celebrating 10 years of Mocha Jacksonville's Project Atrium series. That's after this. We'll be right back.
This week on Science Friday, the right and wrong way to leave a conversation.
Most of the time in a conversation, it's not an appropriate time to go, all right, see you later.
Plus everything you wanted to know about teeth, especially baby teeth.
My question is, why do teeth move around so much before they fall out?
All on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on WJCT News 89.9.
President Biden moves up the vaccine supply timeline, New York's governor stays put, and trending on Twitter, Texans react to this announcement with the hashtag, I hate it here.
I am ending the statewide mask mandate.
I'm Jen White. We'll catch up on all the biggest headlines around the country this week on the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, Mocha Jacksonville is celebrating 10 years of its acclaimed Project Atrium series with a new project called Imagination Squared. Now, this is inspired by a public exhibition that took place a decade ago and kicked off the whole Project Atrium series. Right now on the line, we welcome Ylva Rouse, Mocha's senior curator. Ylva, good morning. Ylva Rouse, I should say. Ylva, good morning.
Good morning.
And artist Christina Ford, who created the original Imagination Squared series 11 years ago. Hey, Christina.
Hi, good morning. Thank you.
And in a moment, we'll go back to that, because I well remember when you created this back in 2010. But first, Ylva, tell us a little bit about Project Atrium. You're celebrating 10 years of this series, which has been fantastic for Mocha Jacksonville.
Yeah, the Project Atrium really is our star project in the museum in the sense that it gives a unique opportunity for artists to do what we call a site-specific project. So an installation that responds to the space and to the community in a very special way.
Christina, back in 2010, you created the original Imagination Squared series. Let's go back to that original exhibit and describe it a little bit for our listeners, and then we'll talk about what you have going now.
That sounds great. My fellow artist and friend, Dolph James, and I got together regularly back in 2010, and one day kind of came up with this idea to do a creative response project, which would essentially encourage an egalitarian voice of the community members, specifically geared towards non-artists. And we thought it would be fun to distribute kind of quietly through the community wood squares, allow people to modify them and return them within a finite window. And then we promised we would put them all together collectively in public. And we approached Mocha Jacks, and they were willing to do it, which was so exciting to everyone who participated, and had a huge, huge opening on September 1st in 2010. It moved virally and quietly through the community, and it was sort of this really exciting thing that unified artists from such a large and expansive area in Jacksonville. It was a wonderful celebration of the different voices in Jacksonville.
Sure. And that really livened up that atrium space in the museum, Ylva. So this new project is open to anyone, right? Anyone can pick up a square and participate in this. Tell us a little bit more about how that can be done.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yes, we thought it would be such a great project for these times, particularly to have a creative response to document this moment. And anybody can participate. It's in the same spirit as the original one. We've had over 800 participants sign up so far, and you can still get a square. They have to be turned in by March 21, so we're getting close. But each participant, it can come by Mocha during our opening hours and pick up their 10 by 10 inch wood panel on which to create their work of art.
And Christina, anything goes just about, right? I mean, no pornography, but people can do whatever they want artistically with this square once it's theirs.
Absolutely. I mean, adhering anything, funky objects or carving it up or disrupting it in any way. So it's not just a painting surface at all. It's very sculptural.
What were some of the most interesting ones that came in the last time?
We had incredible sculptures from leading artists in Jacksonville. I remember one from David Ponsler that was a bronze sculpture. There were several that were bereavement squares that were in honor of people who had passed. There are actually some squares of people who are now passed. So art, of course, serves as a legacy of expression. And so it's pretty fabulous time capsule of what was happening in Jacksonville in 2010. And we gave it to the city at that time in 2011. So it currently hangs permanently in the main library right now on the concourse level. So it's very impressive, and I've noticed over the years that people definitely use it as a destination spot for their selfies.
Yeah, very nice. Mm-hmm. Now, Ylva Rouse, going beyond this series, tell us a little bit about Mocha's plans for spring and summer, particularly as more people get vaccinated and things continue to open up.
Yes, absolutely. We are continuing our plan to slowly open following the CDC guidelines. And, of course, we all have our hopes on the vaccine that we all following so closely. So, but we continue having visitors with safety guidelines. So please come by the museum. There are a lot of exciting shows that you've featured, Melissa, on your show. And we continue having a really robust online presence, so you can always visit our website and do virtual tours of all the exhibits. So lots going on.
Lots going on. Check it out at mochajacksonville.org. And if you want to participate in Imagination Squared, stop by the museum pick up a 10 by 10 wood panel and create your work of art. The deadline to turn your square back in to be part of the exhibit is March 21st, and the show opens April 16th. Thank you so much, artist Christina Ford and Ilva Rouse, MoCA Senior Curator, for being with us today. Have fun with
it. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening, and thanks to all of our guests and callers, along with producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, news director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. Make sure to join us today at noon on the Florida Roundup. That's our live statewide call-in program where we round up the biggest stories from the week. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Have a great Friday, everybody.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.